Hello, and welcome to Byzantine Dreams. In this episode, we speak with Sarah Friend, a badass infrastructure developer, digital artist, activist, and community crypto pioneer who works on Circle's UBI and currently lives in Berlin. As a former occupier, Sarah was one of the earliest developers in the Ethereum ecosystem. Today, she is part of the core team for Circles, a UBI-like project originally conceived of half a decade ago. Circles launched in October of this year, quickly amassing over 100,000 signups, making it one of the most subscribed community crypto projects to date. In one of our favorite conversations so far, Sarah joins us to set the record straight on Circles, what it is, how it is and isn't at all, like state-sponsored basic income projects, and why she thinks of it as a science fiction proposition for how money could be.
We then zoom out, digging into how Sarah sees cryptocurrencies and peer-to-peer tech in general as the means for charting out new zones of social possibility. The linchpin of both Circles and Sarah's art practice is an emphasis on physical place and creating tools for local communities to take ownership and control over their lived environments. We delve into her art practice, her take on the current state of so-called crypto art powered by NFTs or non-fungible tokens, and the vital role Captain Picard and Baby Yoda play in our collective imagination. Careful listeners will also note the return of Web Rings and Solarpunk from our episodes with Christian and Amber. That and more is coming up on this episode of Byzantine Dreams.
Welcome, everyone, to Byzantine Dreams. Today, we've got Sarah Friend joining us. So Sarah, we've known each other for quite some time. We met back in 2016 when she joined Consensus as one of the earlier software engineers. And folks may not know, but she's responsible for a lot of infrastructure built in some of the early dApps in the early Ethereum days. And most recently, she is working on the UBI crypto project Circles. And in addition to her work as a software engineer, she's also a digital artist that uses software as a medium and has contributed to several different projects at the intersection of digital art, community, and sometimes even crypto. So welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Caroline. That was great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So we usually like to start off giving the floor for just a couple minutes on your backstory, how you got here. This is sort of a crypto podcast. So
the classic, how did you end up in crypto question?
Right. The quote rabbit hole story or whatever you want to share, but I'll hand the floor over to you to do a quick intro.
Yeah, for sure. Yours was very comprehensive. So fun facts about me. I have a degree in painting. So I have been an artist since before I was a software developer. And another thing that I've been since before I was a software developer was a financial activist. I graduated from university in 2010. I was an occupier in my city and was pretty critical of the forces that shaped the fiat ecosystem and actually simultaneously the economic forces in the art world. When I first heard about Bitcoin, I kind of had this moment of recognition. I knew right away that this was something that I thought was going to be important or at least interesting. A couple of years later, I was at Ricoh Center in New York, which is a sort of unschool or retreat for programmers. And I spent a lot of my time there doing my first Ethereum project. Which was a integration with the game engine Unity. I was like, yeah, we're going to make infrastructures for countries and nation states on the blockchain. And those worlds should look like actual worlds. So we got to use game engines to build them, which still feels like the most sci-fi thing. But that's what I was doing before I joined Consensus.
Ha!
That's awesome. I didn't know you were a recursor.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great program. And the time that I could spend there, like learning about new subsets of programming, is really like what allowed me to pivot into working in crypto.
Oh, awesome.
Cool.
So what's some of the infrastructure you worked on at Consensus? The Ethereum developer ecosystem is, it's a lot more built out than it was in like 2015, 2016. There are barely even any tokens at this point.
Totally. ERC-20 was like a very novel concept then. So I think it would be flattering me to say that anything I did is still in use. I think that everything has been rewritten now and much better. The project I started working on was Balance, a project which I'm not sure actually exists anymore.
Ledger.
Oh God. that was like one talk done by Christian Lundqvist. What we were actually doing is like a much more mundane solution for paying your crypto taxes. So it was the early days of ERC-20, but there was almost no way back then to get information about your ERC-20 transfers. Like, you can get this on Etherscan now. It's just so obvious. Every wallet supports it. So the first thing I worked on was an indexer that specifically held all of the information about ERC-20 tokens. Their indexers have come so far, but there was this moment in early crypto where like every project built their own indexer. Yeah. But now, you know, like very few projects run their own infrastructure, even fewer feel the need to write their own indexer. And there are projects like The Graph that do a pretty good job of this for most people.
Yeah. That's a pretty interesting story. But yeah, I'd love to dive into the project that you're working on now. Circles, which we were chatting about earlier, has been in existence for quite some time, kind of as a concept, and just recently launched this year. So I think it would be helpful to just hear from you. What is Circles? The history of the project? You know, when did you get involved? What do you do with them? And then to hear a little bit about how the launch went recently.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Circles is one of those projects that's been kicking it around the crypto space for a long time. I think the first version of the white paper was in 2015. I'd have to fact check this, but it was definitely floated around from the time I started at Consensus. And that was written by Martin Kopelman, one of the founders of Gnosis. So Circles existed for a long time before the phase of development that actually got it launched started. That, I would say, started in August or so of last year. Mm-hmm. The team at first tried to build it with open source volunteer contributors, which is very hard to get a project to launch with. Then, you know, we came to the team we have now, which is 5 people. I'm one of 2 developers. There's also 2 folks who do community and business development in Berlin and 1 UX person. We launched in October on XDAI, which is an Ethereum sidechain. And within 6 to 7 hours of launch, we were down under load. And so we set up infrastructure that could handle like significantly more than our test period, but we vastly underestimated the need. And of course, being a bunch of like eco-friendly do-gooding types, we had set everything up on a geothermally powered server in Iceland.
No way. Oh. Awesome.
Yeah, but that server company is very small. It doesn't have any of the tools that like a big digital hosting provider has to scale up quickly. Our team had no dedicated DevOps or SRE people, so we had to like call in a friend to help us in this emergency situation. Anyway, the whole thing was kind of crazy. I remember we launched on Friday. Say never push important things on Friday. Anyway, we did. Yeah, I didn't take a day off for like more than 2 weeks. So it was hectic. It seems to have died down. I think a lot of the buzz to sign up for Circles immediately was based in this promise of free money. You know, the crypto community primes people a lot with 2 things. 1, you know, money gets airdropped to you sometimes. And 2, the earlier you're in, the better. These are both sort of true for Circles, but not true in the way that they normally are. I think people didn't understand these aspects of the project and just like spammed us.
Well, this could be a good opportunity to set it straight a little bit. Like, what's the overarching goal of Circles and how does it work as a user?
Yeah, Circles is kind of like a universal basic income. Our name is Circles UBI or Circles UBI. But I think sometimes that the word UBI does us as much harm as it does benefits. It's this really popular term. It draws in a lot of attention. And it's not the worst explanation of what we're doing, but it's also not the most accurate. I think maybe more accurate would be to say that we're an alternative currency or a community currency. And there are mechanisms inside that alternative currency that have the property of redistributing wealth or changing the way wealth is distributed over time in a community. But it's not doing the thing that most people think of when they think of UBI, which is taking money that is already a currency that is already widely used from certain wealthy people or certain large companies and redistributing that to those who need it. That is not what we're doing. We're our own currency, and it becomes valuable as it is used by a community. So, you know, it's a much slower process. If you sign up, but no one in your, you know, that you transact with regularly is part of Circles. Obviously there's nothing to buy. It's not doing a very good job being a basic income that provides for your basic needs in that circumstance. Mm. So really there's all this like social and community labor that has to happen, which we have people on our team who do or are focused on doing. Mm. So yeah, that's the one of the main differences between UBI. The money is not automatically valuable. You can't use it at the grocery store tomorrow. But then the other thing is, of course, it's paid out to everyone who's in the system. Okay. And it's paid out every day. And currently that's about 8 circles a day. So, you know, for every additional day that I get in early, it's only 8 more circles, and I'm going to get 8 more tomorrow and the day after too. So the advantage of getting in early is, instead of significant, like it is with most blockchains, it's actually extremely small. At the hype cycle, right? Like it peaks and then it dies down. And then you get to take time off sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's like that with a lot of new projects. Like people are primed to just kind of jump in and get some and participate. And then the learning about, okay, what is this system and how is it different often happens after.
Or like the yield farming story maybe of like, get in before someone hacks it.
Oh, yeah, that too.
I feel like that actually would be effective marketing copy.
It probably.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, to be honest.
Yep.
Like, let's call it like we see it, folks. Wait, could we talk a little bit about the particulars of the launch? So I think there have been something like at least like 10,000 registrants, right?
Far more. There were 10,000 pretty, like within the first week. When I last looked, there were 65,000 who had completed the sign-up process.
Oh, wow.
And over 100,000 who had started it. Cool. So if you haven't already used Circles, you make an account and then you have to be trusted by 3 people who have already finished the sign-up process themselves. This is enforced only in the UI. This isn't enforced in the contracts or any other parts of the infrastructure.
Oh.
We pay for people's transaction fees on the XDAI network. And though they are very low, we wanted to introduce like a slight barrier. The second thing it's doing is Circles moves along these paths of trust between people. So Circles is more useful to you when you're trusted. So, you know, some people sign up and then they don't actually finish. So we had like these 65,000 who finished and then 100,000 who had started. It's nuts. Some of it might be automated traffic, actually. There are some rings of bots using the Circles network.
No.
Well, that's what DeFi is full of these days. So I wouldn't be surprised that somebody's taken some of their bots. Yeah, interesting.
The thing is, all these bots can only spend their circles with each other. So it's like...
Let there be bots.
Yeah, exactly. I'm bot friendly as long as they don't, you know, hammer my infrastructure too hard.
This is like a more humane, you know.
Bots are people too.
Yeah, bots are people too. We can have autonomous agents, you know, the refrigerators and the home appliances forming their trust circles.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it might be happening. There are definitely like Telegram channels where you post in them and then like 3 people will trust you to get you verified like right away.
And oh, Yeah, wait, could we talk more about the trusting verification mechanism and maybe just how identity is baked into the project in general? Mm-hmm. And like, what is a circle? You know?
Well, generally circles, when we say circles, we mean the tokens that are issued. Mm-hmm. Like we call them circles. It uses a web of trust, which is a sort of primitive that comes up in the crypto community from time to time and is older than cryptocurrency. It's from crypto as in cryptography. I think it was first used with PGP. It's a way of saying that you believe that, in a PGP context, that the key that you are trusting or signing belongs to a person who is who they're claiming to be. In circles, it's similar. If I trust you, what that's ideally means is that I believe you are not using the system fraudulently. Fraudulently would mean collecting multiple basic incomes, being a refrigerator with a circles account. And it also means that I'm committing to exchange my circles for your circles on a one-to-one basis. So everyone actually has their own circles token, which stays attached to their identity. And I only interact with circles tokens that I trust, as does everyone in the circle system. So that's why these bots, you know, if there's a giant bot network, but nobody trusts the bots can only hurt the other bots. So, you know, their effect is limited. It's maybe like you can imagine sort of like an immune system, like walling off the Sybil army. It's been a real process to try to think about as we're developing the app, like how to educate people about these concepts around trust. And then also someday to assess whether our users understood.
Yep. Yeah. And everything behaves differently on mainnet, I suppose. Do you guys have plans to migrate to, you know, mainnet now, waiting for ETH 2, work with different scaling tech at all?
Nothing planned. With transaction fees the way they are on mainnet, it's completely unaffordable for us. The target Circles user does not have any cryptocurrency besides Circles. Mm. And having to pay transaction fees in something that isn't Circles token is not something we ever want to force people to do. To be honest, I think we would be... So there's like a Circles dream world where we actually build our own blockchain, where Circles users pay their transaction fees in their Circles tokens. We'd also love for this to not be proof of work mined. But there is one project that is similar in many details to Circles that actually does have their own blockchain and uses the web. It leverages the web of trust actually to do mining. It's called Dunader and it's based in Toulouse, France. Hmm. And it also is like kind of like a universal basic income currency. The way their mining algorithm works is in webs of trust, there's a concept called the strong set. So you sort of start with a seed set of users, and all these nodes which are strongly connected are considered real. Dunader, you need 5 signatures to join, and once you're trusted by 5 people who are already in the strong set, you too are in the strong set. Hmm. It's really hard to get 5 people in Toulouse who are part of Dunader to trust you, by the way. We tried. and then once a key is in that set, it's allowed to mine blocks. It's considered trusted. So there's work done in this direction already of sort of using the types of identity and assumptions about identity you can make from web of trust to also do mining.
That's super cool. Might be useful to zoom out a little bit at this moment. Why do you think that UBI or even just community currencies is something important for us to be thinking and talking about today? You mentioned that you guys have some folks working on like community work and use cases. I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about that or just any sort of visions for what UBI and community currency can mean for our future.
Yeah, for sure. Circles in particular has something that most UBI proposals don't have. Actually, 2 things, but they're connected. One, it's not a state-based solution. So I think we're maybe living in a moment where democracy is in crisis. And maybe some of us are considering that we don't trust the governments of the countries that we live in new ways. And certainly in the history of UBI pilots and UBI experiments around the world, some of them have been ruled out for the purposes of research and then cut short because of electoral changes. So this is actually the case where I'm from. I'm from Ontario, and there was a UBI pilot happening in Hamilton, which is a former industrial city that had pretty serious loss of jobs around the time that manufacturing was crumbling in North America. So it's still a city with lots of poverty. So it was chosen to do a big UBI pilot there. The government of the province changed. There was an election, and then the new government shut down the pilot. So this is to say that projects like Circles, should they be successful or beneficial to any community, aren't subject to any kind of changes like this. You know, it's fun in the project, in the context of blockchain projects, you often say, like, does your project really need a blockchain? And one of the answers is like, well, it does if you want to have money without a trusted authority. Like, that's what it's for. And so I'm like, oh, well, so that actually applies to Circles. Like, Circles is trying to be money, and we would like to not have a single authority that could shut it down. So there's the first thing. Circles can live without friendly government through any sort of government changes, theoretically at least. But also, you know, Circles is something we can build and start using now. We don't need to wait for anyone else. We don't need to wait for any permission. We don't need to wait for an appeal to public officials to do this for us. This is something that you can use in whatever community you're part of now. I think Circles is an experiment that deserves to be tried. Human societies deserve to know what will happen if something like Circles gets rolled out en masse. And we won't know that for a while. Like, it might not work, but someone should try, right?
Circles is almost like a science fiction proposition of what money could be. Did I get that right?
Yeah. There are many differences between Bitcoin and Circles, of course. But there's definitely a similarity also in that they both just are money. They're not a dApp that is using money. They both sort of are it. They're also propositions for how money could be or how money could move that are fundamentally different from what we experience in, you know, the world of the various fiat currencies we all use. If you look sort of historically at money and the history of all the things that have been used for money throughout human civilization, there's actually like a very large possible space, right? And yet we've only experienced one version of it. And I think that the thing that is offered by cryptocurrency in general is the possibility to reconsider that. Yeah, that's I think what Circles is trying to do. I say that it's like a science fiction proposition because, well, I mean, for a long time it was only talked about, not real. but even still, I think it's like it's got a meme value that is bigger than its actual value right now. And people come to the project all the time and they say, you know, that they like never believed that something like this could exist. Fun fact about Circles. At one point, Circles was advised, we did not go do this, but we were advised that legally we should say we were an art project to avoid any possible repercussions. So I guess that's another, you know, Circles, the whole Circles project might just be an elaborate performance.
You heard it here, folks.
Yeah. If arrested for Circles related charges, please try this defense and do not. I just think it's a really funny story. The slipperiness between what's real and not, right?
Could I ask you, what is your favorite personal Circles transaction to date?
Well, I sold a table for Circles.
Oh.
The other day. I'm pretty happy about that. Because hey, I mean, I sold something for Circles, something real, it feels cool. So yeah, that's my personal one. And I guess also maybe my favorite email we've gotten. This is so far out, but it did happen. Someone emailed us and was like, I am a landlord. I would like my tenants to be able to pay a portion of their rent in circles. Wow. Can you tell me how? And I mean, we usually think of circles as being more like a pocket money, more like you're going to buy a coffee or like someone's old thing that they would put on Craigslist. But that someone has already floated the idea of paying for a need like rent with circles is just incredibly cool to me. Probably will take a while before that is really happening anywhere, of course, but still encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, if they have any vacancies in the building, I would.
Right? I would also love to live in this building.
Very cool. Well, you know, it's interesting because that intersects with the other area that you work in. And this might be a good time to pivot the conversation a little bit and talk about your experience as an artist, as a digital artist.
Yeah, for sure. I make art with software. And some of that has been crypto projects. My main crypto artwork is called ClickMine, and it's a clicker game. It's like kind of a satirical project, a bit of a trolley joke in some ways. Made it during the ICO boom in 2017 when, you know, headline after headline was just ridiculous amounts of money issued here and there. And so yeah, I issued my own sort of useless token that you could get by like clicking in this game over and over. The other sort of main crypto art intersection is more in terms of infrastructure for artists project that I've been working on over the last year with a gallery in the UK called Furtherfield. And that project is called Culture Stake. And Culture Stake is a project about making cultural decisions, decisions about what type of artworks happen in which localities. So it uses quadratic voting, and they've talked about using it in cities that are looking to replace their Confederate monuments, to have people vote on what they might want to replace those monuments with, which would be crazy, but also a little scary. I've already had one project go down under load, you know. So, yeah, but I'm not. Yeah, but I'm
what
not
is it with you and your geothermal servers can't take it, Sarah?
I love to work overtime, apparently. But yeah, we'll see. It might also be choosing what goes in the normal arts festival, something that won't, you know, possibly attract headlines. We'll see. I've been cautious, I think, though, we spoke about this earlier, about only doing blockchain art projects, because mostly when people say crypto artists, they seem to mean people who use NFT protocols and sell artworks that way, which is not something I've done. So
I'm curious to hear a bit more about, I don't know, your hesitation around only crypto art stuff, and you know, if there's some hot takes under there about the current state of crypto art projects and NFTs, and because you've been around from the beginning as an artist.
I guess to return to what we were talking about earlier, when we were talking about like, can a monetary system be an artwork? If we're interested in making monetary systems that are artworks, that seems to be a sort of different practice or process than making images. Mm-hmm. And then selling them with, you know, an apparatus that uses a blockchain. I mentioned that I was a financial activist and I was critical of the art economy. One of the things that I was very critical of was the markets that art was sold in, the scarcity and preciousness as forces, and artworks that were purchased primarily for investment and not for, you know, any actual appreciation of the artwork. There are these giant warehouses full of artworks in ports. And the reason that the artworks are kept in ports is that they're never fully imported. You don't have to pay taxes on them. Mm. And so these artworks just sit and aren't seen or appreciated. And I suppose I've always found this like a little bit sad. Like I don't make art so that it can go and like sit in a port and then be sold someday to go sit in someone else's port. And to me, I think about if artworks are sold For me, that sale or the mechanisms by which it is sold are as worth thinking about as artistic mediums, as the object itself. So I don't sell work. I usually make my work open source and free to interact with online, kind of with the exact opposite rationale of let's put it in like a vault and hope it becomes more precious over time. It's like, let's let everybody try it. And like you yourself could spin up my artwork on your own computer if you wanted to. And I'm not really opposed to selling art, but if I were to, I would probably want to do it in a way where the transaction became part of the process. And I don't think that that's really what's offered by NFT markets as they exist now. There's also been a lot of confusion, you know, getting invited to panels to speak about blockchain art, and people are talking about NFT markets. And I'm like, I'm really more interested in like what in like what a monetary system could be. I think there's a fair point also that some of the markets around NFTs, even if someone treats them only as a speculative investment, democratizing access to what has historically been a very closed speculative market, the speculative market for artworks, I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that that's positive.
Yep, no, I agree. But I think I understand where you're coming from in terms of the marketplace for NFTs looking similar to the traditional model of speculation. And you like to think bigger.
I like to make things that are more far out and less practical.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel that different from the $10 million stuff shark problem with the existing art market. The feeling I get is like, you know, Damien Hirst smoked DMT in a video arcade and then they're sold a bunch of tokens on it.
I mean, Damien Hirst was an economic artist for sure.
Yeah.
I think a lot of his stunts were actually really about how they affected the art market as much as they were about objects. And Andy Warhol used to do this kind of thing too.
My old professors used to say about Andy Warhol is there was this like real underlying tension in a lot of the work that's like, yeah, is this really it? That's actually where he saw all the richness in Warhol's work.
Mm-hmm. I think that for a lot of artists who end up with the like massive price tags, at some point, the fact that they're creating financial instruments as much as anything else becomes part of what they do. It's hard to avoid or ignore. It's an open secret. Everyone knows this about these artworks.
I'd be interested to take it the other direction with this art conversation and ask you about a lot of the commonality across your work is that you're looking at like localities and local communities and sort of empowering people to create value within these smaller contexts. And I guess I'm curious to hear a bit more about that and how you think crypto or not can help enrich local communities around culture and art.
So it's you're right in pointing this out. Both Culture Stake and Circles are focusing on communities and maybe in some ways not scaling on purpose. So yeah, I think that for me, I gravitate to projects like this because of an ideological belief or constraint, which is that I think that building for a universal user or a universal place is kind of a colonizing instinct, actually, and common in the tech industry, you know, to build things for like the every user or the every place. And, you know, I think that I don't want to work in that modality, and I don't want to make claims about what might work in many places. You know, you can sign up for Circles anywhere, but we are fairly careful about saying, oh, well, you should be the one who organizes around this in your own community. I think there's also working locally. It's a scale at which we can have immediate effect. Maybe you could make a climate argument about working locally as well, but I'm not sure it's the most applicable to either of these projects. Also, I want to say I thought of my final NFT point that I like stumbled on before. So I'll throw it out just for the hell of it. Yeah. It was a Simon de la Riviere tweet. And I know he's been a guest on this show, so it's worth bringing up. It was pointing out, you know, there's this thing where you buy an NFT artwork and it's like a JPEG. And you're like, ha, 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 I can screenshot your JPEG, you know. I can download an image of the $10,000 stuffed shark and, like, put it on my wall, right? So maybe you don't really own it at all. And it was the proposition that maybe the prestige object of the future, we all have digital picture frames, right? We all put JPEGs in them of whatever we like. And it's not owning something that nobody has that is the prestige object of the future. It might be owning something that everybody has. So I actually have this authentic certificate of the JPEG that is on a billion people's walls, which I thought was like kind of like an interesting perspective on scarcity. The art world thrives on scarcity. Google does not. Which I guess I've been thinking about a lot in terms of how I make what I make. Are they always necessarily in opposition? Everyone having it or a scarce object?
Well, you know, I think you're touching on something really interesting here. I haven't seen a piece of artwork at scale that's really thrives on like network effects, right? Mm-hmm. So like, are there artworks we could, you know, create or define that like get more compelling and beautiful as more and more people use them, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe like currencies are a good example of that, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I just did an artwork that is a bit in this direction. And it's like one of these things is like, is it even an artwork or is it like infrastructure? But this summer I made a web ring. I made it in collaboration and consultation with some other folks who are all part of a residency called Her Visions at Arbeit Gallery, and especially in consultation with Brenna Murphy, who's another artist. It started from thinking about big tech platforms and how artists need to, for career reasons, participate in things like Instagram, but then also the navigability of the web is monopolized pretty much by Google. So it was thinking about what would moving away from that mean, or how might we link our websites together in a way that defies the power of scraping bots, you know? But the thing that makes me think about it as a network artwork is that artists who join install this code on their own website that sort of pops up a little link to another artist's website. So the documentation photos, you know, you always document your artworks, you take photos of them. The documentation photos are all these screenshots of like other people's websites, basically, with this little thing installed. And the more people who join it, you know, the more rich and interesting this set becomes. But there's more work to be done in this direction.
It seems like you are doing a lot to consider the context and the social life and the transmissibility of artworks, right? It's not like, oh, I made this image and that's the thing. And then like how it gets distributed or how people interact with it. Like that's outside of the frame, right? The frame is the whole field of interactions that the work is embedded in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely core to how I think about art. I'm like the whole, like what is the frame? You know, the whole world is the frame possibly, or like you can pick or curate the environments that your art lives in more creative ways than a literal rectangle for a flat thing.
We were chatting earlier back to the state of the world in 2020, the environment, and just the ecological crisis that we find ourselves in. I know that this is also something that you're passionate about and have done activist work around. If you want to talk to us a little bit about the meme collective that you're a part of, or...
Sure. Yeah. Art and ecology... Maybe we should start with the meme page. Yeah. So Carolyn mentioned the meme page, which y'all should follow. I do not run it. I am a participant in it. It was started by a mutual friend of all of ours, Saraswathi Subbaraman, where, you know, memes as a propaganda tool, basically. Or like maybe you would say it's the horny for nature meme page. but it's all like, you know, memes about ecology, memes about regenerative practices. And it's called Zyrden, Z-Y-R-D-E-N, and it is on Instagram. There's some hits in there. So please lurk. And yeah, I am very interested in, attentive to the ecological circumstances we find ourselves in. It's funny, I'm not sure that UBI and degrowing or adapting to a new environmental reality are actually so aligned. You know, typically when governments want to increase growth, and with growth, usually at least, the burden on the environment, they give people money. So we're giving a bunch of people money. Will the end result be actually more consumption? It's not clear. It's a big question. One of the thornier ones for UBI, I would say. I guess to zoom out even more, as an artist, one of the questions I'm asking myself most often is, can art be a catalyst in social change? Or is the project of being an artist frivolous compared to the many large problems that are facing us as a culture? But actually, I was thinking about this just this morning. And I was thinking about Star Trek, because I'm watching Star Trek Next Generation right now. It's like the most posy show ever. It's kind of this like post-scarcity utopia, right? This doesn't get talked about a lot on Next Generation, which is the show I'm currently watching. But like the replicator is the core to like everything that they do, right? I think there's also this show, you know, like, really strong values, explores a lot of really progressive things, certainly for the time that it was made. If I'm looking for, you know, like an art or cultural project that has positive impact, it's like Star Trek is a really great example. Like, I feel like a better person because I watched Star Trek. Like, I'm like, what would make Captain Picard proud of me today? But I was thinking about this because it wasn't necessarily what I would think of when I think of art, but I think it's an example of science fiction work that probably has had positive effects on people. I was thinking about how can I like make work that's more like Star Trek, basically.
I think that's a question we should all be asking. I love Next Generation.
Yeah, my mother, she was a Trekkie growing up, and I definitely think that impacted her worldview in a positive way. And like, you know, how she raised us, and you know, she's an environmental scientist, right? You know, science fiction and art, there's a lot of good that can do in the world.
Yeah, I feel like it's a good example if you're looking for like an answer to that question, which I seem to perpetually be doing.
I feel like there's like a oil painting of Patrick Stewart in your work area.
No.
There's rosary beads and a candle.
I'm just, okay, this won't be apparent to viewers at home. I have this poster that I'm going to put up. It's not a Star Trek poster. And this is a poster of Baby Yoda that I'm holding up. Because, you know, I guess during the first lockdown here, it was also the biggest era of Baby Yoda memes, and they brought me a lot of joy. And I was like, my boyfriend bought me this Baby Yoda, but maybe I'll have to add a card to put beside him. Yeah. And then when all the like curators and art professionals come to my studio, they're going to be like, what is going on here?
You're like, this is so meta, meta, meta. You guys are 5 years behind. You know, you want to be the change that, Baby Yoda wants to see in the world.
To make a world that's safe for Baby Yoda. Jesus, I can't believe that's going to go on a podcast.
Well, but honestly, I do think that's like the affect that's behind a lot of these Baby Yoda memes, right?
I mean, it's pretty similar to like animal video therapy, you know?
Yeah, which is its own ideology.
Yeah, totally. Which I'm guilty of participating in, for sure. Like, I'm sad. Like, let's look at cute animals.
Yeah, no, it's therapeutic, and just memes itself, it's a language. And I think through that lens, you can definitely argue that you know, art is a language. And I think that, you know, back to your original question about you know, social change and art, and I think it's inseparable, right? You know, art is always going to be a language for social change and like cultural push forwards. Can't even pull it apart.
Yeah, I think that it has been at many points, but I don't know. I think it's a very complicated relationship also. I think that there's a phenomenon of a shared aesthetic language being used by different ideological camps. And also, are aesthetic tendencies, and do they have any sort of built-in meaning, or do they kind of like float across the political borders? One of the like kind of examples that I came across, and I was like, my God, I can't believe this is what this looks like, is the Amazon headquarters talking about solar punk, right? Solar punk, if you Google it, you see all these like organic buildings. They look like greenhouses, lots of trees in them. If you Google the Amazon headquarters, it's these green glass domes. They're like super organic. They look like it could be in a solar punk illustration, but it's the headquarters of Amazon. And I think that that's an example for me how it's always worth asking questions about like the structure of something outside of how it appears.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, I'm reminded when you're speaking about Heidegger, who I think produced some of the most beautiful philosophical thinking of the 20th century, right? But to say that there are political problems there is really an understatement.
Yeah, it's a classic philosophical question. And, you know, to pull back to crypto, I've observed the kind of same phenomenon happening with decentralization marketing. You know, it feels like every political tendency has tried to market or advocate for decentralization too. So it can lead to some uncomfortable moments.
Yeah. So the last question I wanted to ask, you've talked in the past about, oh, there are many different decentralizations and decentralization is kind of this neutral thing that lots of different folks with different agendas can kind of co-opt. At what moment do you think we are in the cycles of centralization and decentralization or just like P2P tech in general? And we'll link in our show notes your talk about this. But any update on that conversation for our listeners?
It's hard to say. Are we in a moment where I think things are too centralized? In terms of tech, I think that the answer is yes. There's many areas where you are forced to be part of a monopoly if you want to survive. I mentioned earlier that it's very difficult to be an artist and not be on social media at all. It's very difficult to get your app in the App Store if Apple doesn't like it. It's really hard to use the internet at all if you don't have a Google account. I co-run a conference called Our Networks, which is about all aspects of the peer-to-peer web. And we get a lot of people who really have tried to de-Google, so don't have a Google account at all. We made a form on our website for presenters to fill out just to give us like basic information. What time zone are you in? Or what is your full name? And accidentally, that form used a Google reCAPTCHA, which apparently is like quite annoying to use if you don't have a Google account. Anyway, there were maybe like 30 something presenters and we got multiple complaint emails about this form. And I mean, it says so much about our community and I really like being held to that standard of like, don't force anyone to use anything by Google. But it's also a great example of just how hard it is. Like it sneaks in there, just a form plugin for a website that doesn't say anything about big tech on it. I think that this is a problem. It's very depowering. I think that there's a bit of a literacy question as well. Like the more people offboard understanding of how technology works to big services, the more you're at their mercy. For the WebRing project that I talked about, you know, it was really interesting to me how many people who wanted to participate couldn't install it because they were using a CMS that just completely locked down the code of their own website, which is maybe like a familiar thing for the crypto community is like, if I own something, is it really mine? Though this is an older story than crypto, right? Because this goes back to like attempts to lock up digital content like DRM. So, but yeah, I think that there are reasons why things have evolved the way they have, but there's a lot of work to be done in proliferating alternatives, especially when big platforms are so integral to how we access information, what information is discoverable. I think that in the tech industry in particular, there's a lot of monopolistic tendencies that I would love to see changed. And I also think that we're in a very good period for peer-to-peer. So yeah, I'm excited for that aspect of 2021 at least.
Awesome. Well, cool. Yes, you like fired off our bazooka of questions here. is there anything else that we didn't get to that, I guess, Sarah, you wanted to jump in about?
Sarah, if there's anything you want to share about where listeners can find you,
totally.
We're going to link all of these cool projects and talks that we've mentioned in the show notes. But yeah, if there's anything else you want to plug.
I think if you link everything we talked about, you'll have done very well. Y'all were very comprehensive.
Sarah, you're a delightful human working on a lot of very interesting things. So it's easy to weave everything together. And thanks for coming on Byzantine Dreams.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And yeah, it's been a great convo.